Nina to what we're going to be talking about today, which is a paper you wrote about something called the problem of bad epistemic company. And this is something that's pretty unexplored territory, but it's the flip side of something that I think a lot of people watching probably are not familiar with, some are, but that at least academic philosophers have spent a lot of time talking and thinking about, which is the problem of epistemic peer disagreement. So I thought maybe we could ease into the bad epistemic company by talking about the epistemic peer disagreement. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so I think that is a useful way to begin. So the problem of peer disagreement is put almost as simply as possible, is just the problem that you face when you encounter somebody who's just as smart as you, just as informed as you, by your own lights, you regard them as equal in those ways, but they disagree with you. And so that opens up an obvious question. Are you wrong? How did you end up with different beliefs? One of you has to be wrong in a case of true disagreement. And so kind of like the simple case that gets people going on this problem is like, you imagine you calculate a tip at a restaurant and your friend, who you have no reason to think you're better at math than they are, they calculate the tip and they get a different number, but you are both going for 20% or whatever it is. You know, it's intuitive there that we would both want to double check our math and that kind of thing. But this problem really exists in the domains of belief, religion, politics, science. There's all kinds of domains where we encounter disagreement by people who, by our own lights, are just as informed and rational and clever as us. And so there's a whole literature of philosophers giving different versions of the problem, different ways of responding to it, and so on.
Yeah, so in that tip case, you know, I think most of us have the conciliatory intuition about this. In other words, that the fact that your friend who, you know, is not obviously worse at math than you or anything like that got a different number when you're calculating it gives you at least some reason to be worried that you might be wrong. Not necessarily a decisive reason to think you are wrong, but like enough of a reason to double check your figures and say, oh, wait, did I miss something? And that's kind of at least a, you know, simple model for how to think about, you know, bigger disagreements about more important things. And, you know, one of the best ways that I've heard to kind of get into why that, you know, like why it seems rational to think that that's at least some reason to think that you got something wrong, that somebody who seems to be just as smart as you, just as well informed with you as you, just as good at, you know, at reasoning and all of that stuff, came to a different conclusion. I think Roy Sorensen said this, that the like, you know, if you're doing it with, like, if you're doing the calculation with your calculator and, like, you know, you see the other person put it in and you put it into your calculator, you wouldn't think, well, this calculator is mine, so therefore I believe that it got it right, you know, because it's mine, and, you know, like that would just seem like a total non sequitur. But when it's, well, this brain is mine, you know, then we think it does. And, you know, there's an obvious question there about why the disanalogy.
Yeah. And, and so, like, one way of thinking about it is that there's this very, like, perspectival kind of proprietary thing going on where, you know, do you have reason to kind of favor your own perspective, you know? Another kind of aspect of the problem that's interesting is how the subject matter seems to matter. So, like, let's say you and I are both remembering somebody we knew in common, which, you know, we're not having this conversation, but we probably do know a lot of people in common in philosophy. And we, like, I remember them being, like, very tall, and you remember them being, like, not very tall. We might actually literally meet in the middle and think, like, oh, maybe, like, I thought the person was a little taller than they really were, and you might think I thought they were a little shorter. We don't usually do that with, like, something like the evidence for the existence of God. So suppose I think the evidence is decisive and you think the evidence is, like, terrible. There's, practically speaking, negligible evidence. We don't typically decide, well, the evidence must be so-so.
Yeah.
You know, so there are domains where we kind of meet in the middle. There's domains where, like with the tip case, it wouldn't really make that much sense to meet in the middle, even though you could quantitatively.
Yeah, you could, but that's not what you would. That's not what it seems intuitive to do in that case. And it certainly seems like. I mean, there is an interesting tension here, because I think a lot of people who are atheists or agnostics think that there's a version of this that, like, gives you a pretty strong reason to doubt the claims of any particular religion, which, you know, like, I mean, in its typical form goes like, okay, you believe the, you know, claims of Judaism, but come on, if you were born in rural India, you know, you believe the claims of Hinduism. It's just, you know, pure happenstance, and there's nothing about, and even if, I mean, I don't, you know, even if it were the case that, like, there are particular arguments that moved you, you know, we sort of think, yeah, but realistically, right, it's not that you're much better at reasoning, you know, than people who grew up in this other religious tradition. It's just that, like, you got access to the best versions of them at the right time. And I don't know, maybe this is not exactly the same problem, but it's certainly very closely in the neighborhood of it. Whereas, though, like, even a lot of people who would endorse that for religion, like, if they do academic philosophy, I mean, if you take pure disagreement to be a decisive reason to abandon your beliefs and you do philosophy, you're just completely screwed.
Yeah, and that sort of demographic argument, I mean, if you start looking at your political beliefs, your scientific beliefs, and so on, you know, there's a real puzzle there. Now, that doesn't mean there's not disanalogies even so. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's a really fruitful area of inquiry, you know, and in many ways, just as a historical point in the literature, it's like there was sort of the problem of religious pluralism, it was sometimes called, like in philosophy of religion anthologies and stuff, that sort of predated the kind of general attention to the problem of disagreement. As a kind of interesting side point, not to get too much on a tangent, but there is a kind of inverse argument for a kind of bare theism or supernaturalism called the... I don't want to embarrass myself. I think it's the consensus gentem argument or gentem argument,
yeah.
Consensus of the nations. And it's this argument that because some kind of belief.
Is that like Cicero talks about that? Anyway, I might be just remembering this, but I definitely heard this. Please keep going. Yeah.
A version of it there. There's a contemporary paper by Thomas Kelly, I think. The idea is like that. There's something close to universality, not literally. Right. You can find atheists historically, but cross-culturally, cross-historically, there's, you know, it's very common to find some kind of belief in something resembling supernaturalism, right. That we could characterize as supernaturalism. And the thought is that that's some evidence in favor of there being such a thing. You know, it's not a very strong argument, I think, by anyone's lights. But, you know, one of the things you learn in philosophy is that it's okay sometimes to concede that something provides some evidence.
but you think it provides very little evidence, so who cares?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a stronger argument if you're a pagan, because, like, you know, you've at least got the option of saying, oh, here's this list of gods, and here's this other nation's list of gods, and there's a lot of overlap. So, like, maybe these were all stem causally from, like, contact with the same group of gods. I think it gets more complicated, you know, when you're doing both polytheism and monotheism. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a G.A. Cohen in one of the lectures, and he's got this little book, the If You're an Egalitarian, How Come You're So Rich? And he talks about, I mean, his main concern in that is with the political version of it, you know, because he grew up in a family in Montreal, where he was, like, you know, going to communist summer camp and stuff, and it's like, all right, well, I've rejected certain aspects of the, like, Stalinism, you know, that I grew up with, but, like, you know, like, core you know, intuitions about political philosophy are still definitely informed by this worldview that I picked up there. How much should I be bothered by that? And he uses an example, right, though, that's like, okay, but, you know, when he was going to graduate school, he was trying to decide between Harvard and Oxford, and the reasons he went for Oxford had absolutely nothing to do with the philosophical views of anybody who taught there. But, like, he's fairly sure that if he'd gone to Harvard and studied with Quine, Quine would have convinced him that there was no analytic synthetic distinction. And, you know, because he went to Oxford, you know, he strongly believes that there is. And, of course, you know, he read Quine eventually and all that. But, like, in an environment where he was primed to come to the other conclusion and, you know, was going to hear the very best versions of the other conclusion. And, you know, there is something a little bit troubling there. But that's like the standard thing to worry about is, okay, what if people disagree with me who are bad people to disagree with me because, like, there's some reason to think they got it right. And in your paper, what you're concerned with, the like interested wrinkle, is the opposite, right? What if people agree with me who are bad people to agree with me because I have some reason to think that they would get this sort of thing wrong, right? So you start out, you know, with a couple of quotes, and it's a fun assortment because I think I probably and a lot of people have very different reactions to the first two of these. The first is from Noam Chomsky, who, I don't know, it's probably a Q&A or something, and some like lunatic tanky is saying like, hey, the things that you say about the Soviet Union sound like the kind of thing that like the mainstream, you know, Reaganite corporate media says about it. And he says, yeah, whatever. I mean, why should I care about that, right? If I'm right, I mean, I don't really care that in this particular case, bad people, you know, come to the same conclusion for their own very different reasons. I'm sympathetic to that. You know, I know I've just lost a chunk of the audience there, but I'm sympathetic to that. But then the second one is Donald Trump, who has just retweeted a quote from Mussolini that he wasn't aware was a quote from Mussolini. And says, yeah, like, I mean, whatever, who cares, right? I mean, like, it's a good line. It's not troubling to me that Mussolini was the one who said it, you know, because he's not saying in the quote, we should have fascism, here's why. He's just, you know, it's sort of a poetic line about being a sheep or being a lion, you know, and it's like, yeah, who cares? And I think a lot of people, this is one of the big points that you make at the beginning, instinctively, you know, we have very different reactions to the bad company problem when it's people that we don't like having bad company on a point that we disagree with, as opposed to views that seem right to us that are advocated by bad people.
Yeah, and it's not only that we treat them a little bit differently, it's that, like, people act like it's a real, this is especially true in sort of public discourse, people act like it's a real decisive, like, own against someone. If you can point out, like, aha, look, you're allied with the Heritage Foundation or something.
Right.
Whereas in the other direction, when somebody accuses you of making some point that, you know, Charlie Kirk made or something, you don't just say, oh, well, you have to understand, I'm different from him in the following ways. You, like, don't even care. It's like, you know, it's like that. You almost want to accuse them of making a kind of fallacy or, you know, a kind of guilt by association, a kind of informal type of fallacy. And so, yeah, so the sort of driving point of my paper is not that it's never okay to agree with people who you think are bad, or that it's even often a decisive objection to point this out, but that it's something that actually there are many reasons to take it seriously. And it's a sort of, much like the problem of disagreement, in my view, these cases are cases that are a kind of almost call to reflection, both reflection on the world and reflection on your own self, depending on the kind of case it is.
You have been watching a free public preview for a patron exclusive episode of Give Them an Argument. To get the rest of this episode, plus patron-exclusive episodes every single Thursday, as well as patron-exclusive post-games after the regular show every Monday night, and a lot more, head over to patreon.com/BenBurgess. As a friend of mine used to put it, why be foolish?